Hi everyone, I'm Zoe Helena of Cosmic Sister and Psychedelic Feminism, and you're listening to Professionally Psychedelics.
Hello listener, and welcome to the Professionally Psychedelics podcast. I am really pleased to welcome Zoe Helena, the founder and chief visionary officer of Cosmic Sister, to the pod today. Cosmic Sister champions female environmentalist, feminist, and psychedelic voices, giving a platform for many rising stars in the space. Additionally, as the driving force behind the term psychedelic feminism, I cannot wait to pick Zoe's brain and dig deeper into the movement. So, without further ado, Zoe, welcome to the Professionally Psychedelics podcast.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's really great to be here. I always enjoy our conversations.
It's fantastic to have you here, Zoe. And as you all know, our first and customary question is, what led you to the plants?
Oh my goodness. I have to really go back, but to give you an idea, I was born in 1964, which is sort of prime time in the so-called counterculture revolution of the 60s, but I was a kid, so I wasn't running around indulging in psychedelics. However, I do think that most children are pretty psychedelic to begin with, and I certainly was a psychedelic kid. And it was, I happened to be born into a family of professional artists and scientists who really encouraged creativity and imagination. So even more so, I was indulged with that. And I think that knowing that there were psychedelics around me and the culture that was coming out of that, the arts, especially being surrounded by artists, the art that was coming out of that scene was remarkable to be part of as a child. So I really cherished that. And I've spoken with other people who had somewhat similar lifetime experiences in that sort of decade. And for me, that really is an introduction. It's just that I didn't take any psychedelics myself. It would have been inappropriate. Now, flash forward, so that's my attitude. On the other hand, coming out of the 60s, there was also this fear of psychedelics and concern, and really what we started to call backlash in the early 90s feminism, meaning you have something really wonderful and positive moving forward and breaking the rules and sort of like restructuring a breakout era, right? A breakout era, like the 20s, the roaring 20s, the gay 90s in Britain. These were times where culture was really expanding rapidly in good ways. So unfortunately, sometimes that also brings on some other things, and it can frighten or threaten the powers that be that kind of want to push it back. And so that has happened throughout history, and it happened in psychedelics. So I left the psychedelic scene in that sense, growing up, with those negatives or those fears with psychedelics in my psyche, and I never wanted to touch anything. However, I did remain kind of a psychedelic person by nature through my art. So after graduate school, or really towards the end of graduate school as a theatrical at Brandeis University, I had been in a really difficult situation, kind of a Me Too, not really kind of, but a Me Too situation before we had the term Me Too and before there were any laws to protect someone like me. It was very public. Everybody knew, nobody could do anything about it. And it was traumatic. And it more so than I knew it was really miserable, but I didn't understand that I was also going to carry that trauma afterwards. So during the period of time of really surviving that and also thriving as a grad student, in spite of it, I was going to get that degree. And it was a three-year program, not two, right? So it was a difficult program on top of everything. So I did thrive in it. But just to get through as a young woman, it definitely affected me. So I would say those 3 years and the 3 years afterwards became really important to me with psychedelics. But the interesting thing is my psychedelic experiences really were with cannabis. And I know that you're sort of started with cannabis and moving into psychedelics. But cannabis to me is, or at least can be, a psychedelic. And I love that it's so flexible in terms of dose and sometimes, you know, how you ingest it, you know, whether you smoke it or whether you, you know, eat something or drink something or, you know, however you prepare it. You and your intentions going in, you know, you can work with cannabis as an intentional medicine just like you can ayahuasca.
Absolutely. You have a lot of high dose sort of somatic therapies that are using cannabis to elicit that psychedelic sensation.
Yes, and you know, I was then and still am, but especially then I was a total lightweight, so a teeny little dose actually was plenty for me. So as an artist and I was already an accomplished artist at that point, so I had good technique, and I, you know, young people are ready to be artists. I had plenty to say. This is something I mentioned. I kind of wanted to talk about the times versus times of life. That time of my life, early Saturn return, I'm not into astrology really, but I think that the Saturn returns do correlate with a human development cycle. You know, so it was a big shift, which I curiously am going through again. I'm going through my second one. So I think back on those times and where I was and where the culture was. And ironically, it was right when the Anita Hill trials happened, 1990, 1991, and I was glued to the screen because she was really the first person coming out in the media in that way with basically a sexual harassment case. Again, pre-Me Too, but definitely it was a Me Too situation. So that's when I was learning about myself, and there was a lot of weed present, and there was a lot of art, and I was really looking at my ancestry on my mother's side primarily, but I was very open to other parts of my ancestry through music, through dance, through theater, through all of the arts, visual arts as well. And I really was exploring how patriarchy had split the female consciousness in the real world, like as a female in the real world, how I had been trained really by the culture that I could only be pieces of a woman. I couldn't be a full woman because that's what the cultural norms were at the time. That's what was pushed in. It still is, unfortunately. You know, you can be this and you can be that, or you can be a combination of this and that, but you can't be a full woman. It's rare that you would get a character that was a full woman. And so we began to split, many of us. And because I had been an actor and around other actors, professionals, talented people who focused on this idea of presenting, you know, or channeling different characters from your own body. It's what a method actor does, right? It's your own psyche that this character is coming through to a point. So we were really good at being able to create or build or develop characters. And I had realized that I had begun to do that myself, just in order not just to get work, because that was part of it. You know, if you had these sort of developed characters, a little base character mm-hmm. developed, you could run into an audition and ace one of those roles, because practically all the roles were these cliches. You know, the whore, maybe it was a hooker with a heart of gold, or maybe it was the hardcore hooker on the streets, or you know, the mature hooker that ran all the other hookers or whatever.
Sounds like a lot of hookers.
Yeah, a lot of hookers. Oh, well, it was my body type. Okay, that was another thing. This body types, you are also relegated to specific types, which may or may not correlate with who you are. That wasn't me at all. So, you know, on the other hand, I might want to do something like a more intellectual role. So it was, but you couldn't be both, you see. You couldn't be sexual and be intellectual. It was, or you could be that, but then you couldn't be nurturing and creative. I mean, it was this, and it still is. And it, you know, the truth is, it's the same for men. You know, these very separated, this sense of separating ourselves. So it sounds crazy, but back then it was not like split personality syndrome. The weird thing about it, the sense that I had with myself is that I was actually developing them as characters, but they were me. So I was like, that's not right. That's not good. I'm going to bring them all together. This is not healthy. I don't like it. And I want to go out in the world as myself, as a full woman. And so at that time in my life, I began that journey with cannabis. And cannabis helped me get there. And over the years, through art and through and working with cannabis, and there were mushrooms involved. There were mushrooms twice. I definitely healed that, and it's never, if it was some kind of PTSD from my experiences, perhaps, whatever it was, those kind of characters within me, the alters they used to call them back then, they completely came together, and I've never had that sense of them being separate again. I think I can recall them as a memory of a time in my life, but they're not there now. But I bring that up because it's very vulnerable, because it must sound really strange to someone who maybe hasn't thought about that. But the idea of that we put on masks and we go out in the world, this is a human thing. And anybody does it. Everybody does it, but some people do it, you know, in more sophisticated ways, if you will. You know, we're watching spy movies right now. We're actually watching one that's It's called Berlin Station. It was a while back, but they're talking a lot about masks, the masks we wear, and they're very good actors. And there's actually a performing artist in it too in Berlin who's also wearing a mask, or masks plural. So this is on my mind right now. And it was definitely an early way of working with the medicines. And it was wonderful.
And would you say that part of the healing process for you in using psychedelic compounds, various psychedelic compounds, was perhaps the removal of that mask or the masks? What were the sort of real, I guess, healing properties that you really found when you were induced in a psychedelic state?
I think that I would have been unique in that, well, not unique, but different from many people in that I was in the theater world. So we were honing the ability to not really wear a mask, but to channel a character, to develop, create a character that came from you, that lived in you, that you could then express through, a script or unscripted or whatever. So it wasn't a bad thing that I was able to do that. It was actually a real talent and a skill. So it wasn't bad, but I just had come to a realization that maybe I want to be a lot more aware that I'm doing that because I'm doing it too well. I don't like that. And who the hell am I? You know, who am I and who am I in the world? And in a time where I'm looking for love too, like I'm wanting relationships with full men who have fully expressed themselves. I wanted to be able to fully express myself so that someone wouldn't be threatened by somebody who had more to offer than one of those little, you know, pieces of women stick together, you know, like the little cliche, simplistic versions of female, the mother, the whore, the whatever. And that was really in the public conversation at the time too. So I think that for me, going in, one of the things I did with cannabis was I created a series of pre-patriarchal versions of the zodiac signs of all things. It's funny that it's astrology again, but maybe it's because somebody had told me about Saturn return. So I thought, well, I'm going to look at the zodiacs from a different perspective. Maybe I will be able to understand them from more of an archetypal psychology perspective, a mythology conversation, rather than the stuff that kind of pushes me away from it. Because it's not, I don't see it as science. I don't want to insult anybody who's really into astrology. That's not my goal here. But for me, I was really more interested in the archetypal psychology than the idea that we are certain ways because of where we're born and when we're born and the stars and all that. So I looked at these and I started to really go deep into research. I was in Harvard Square at the time, so I was able to find some good primary research as well. And anything I could find to go back further for each of the signs of the zodiac and to express them in visuals as well from what I was gathering. So that was part of my early ancestor medicine work, you know, healing my ancestry. I went with my mother's ancestry, which is indigenous Greek, that's a pre-Greeks. And I went as far back as I could, just sort of seeing, well, obviously these are, you know, Dionysus, for example, that is, you could look at Pan or Capricorn as an early, well, Pan is even earlier than Dionysus, but they're all kind of the same. They have attributes of each other. And if you look at that and you go back even further, that is a male, divine male that resides in a divine female's realm. So it's still pre-patriarchal. So it was that kind of thing. And interesting, you know, it happens to be that Dionysus is also a psychedelic god, very much so. So I was really looking at these things without being in the scene, in the sense of I didn't know about all the McKenna stuff going on. And there was an entire renaissance happening in the 90s psychedelic scene that I missed. But apparently I didn't miss. I must have just sort of felt the energy. I was involved, but I did not realize there were people who were getting together and talking about this. I was doing this alone, mostly. The mushrooms were with Greenpeace. That was fun. We're talking about the early 90s here. So, you know, this is ancient history to a lot of people, probably to you, right? You weren't around. Were you around?
I was physically around, yes, but certainly not of an age to be experimenting with psychedelics. And actually, so moving from the 90s right the way through to the noughties and the 2010s. So Zoe, you have set up Cosmic Sister. You have this amazing collective of folks who are focused on a number of core and important topics, which I'd love for you to delve into in a moment. You've also coined the phrase psychedelic feminism. Now, this is something I mentioned in the introduction. It's also something that perhaps pertains to a few things that you've mentioned earlier in our conversation. You mentioned about sort of your experiences of the patriarchy and your experiences with psychedelics. Now, for our listeners, how would you best describe psychedelic feminism, and how would you say this differs from, I guess, other commonly held definitions of feminism, so to speak?
Oh, I think it's the same as feminism, but just with psychedelics. Although I would say that this, and these are like quick terms for people, because all of these are quite complicated. Feminism is quite complicated. There are a lot of really brilliant people who spend their entire lives and their life work is about contemplating what is feminism and working on feminist issues. So, but the short form, I would say ecofeminism and psychedelics, because again, ecofeminism, like psychedelic feminism, is going to have different definitions. The original people who came up with, or person, and then people who continued it, like Vandana Shiva, she did not invent ecofeminism, but she's probably the most well-known ecofeminist. I love her. I can't think of something that I would flat out disagree with that she says. In fact, I really can. I mean, everything I can remember, I completely relate to and love, but she's a different person. So she's going to have her interpretations and I'm going to have mine. And we're never, ever going to be exactly alike, as nobody ever is. So psychedelic feminism, because I came up with the term and popularized it also, I love that it's taken off and I love that people are working on it. And there have always been psychedelic feminists around, just as a term, but ecofeminism was a term too. So sometimes a term or a name is needed to help really empower a movement. It's an important contribution. It is an actual creative skill, a professional skill. And that's something that I feel that I've contributed. That said, I'm thrilled that so many people are relating and running with it themselves. So for me, back to the ecofeminism and psychedelics. So let's say ecofeminism is really about Earth. And this is where I somehow different. You know, I love the poetry of thinking of Mother Earth. And because, again, that's my ancestry on my matrilineal side, goes all the way back to Neolithic ceremonies with Gaia, who is not just Mother Earth. She is the mother of all. And she is living, breathing Earth and all of life on Earth. So we are of her realm, just like I mentioned Pan and Dionysus are of a divine feminist. Divine feminine, rather, and feminist, Artemis, the goddess Artemis. So of Gaia's realm, we are all of Gaia's realm, right? So ecofeminism is really about that, you know, and specifically the role of patriarchy in that, which really comes down to male supremacy, even though it's a really ugly term. It really is that now that we know what patriarchy is, if we understand that that's wrong, the only reason that you would want to keep it up and keep it going would be if somehow inside you, whether you've internalized the misogyny or not, you have some male supremacy going on. So that's everybody. That's not just men. Not just males have male supremacist values. Females of all, we all are brought up in this patriarchy. So we are all, you know, I want to say mind fucked, but I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that on your podcast. Is that okay?
You're allowed to say mind fucked.
All right, good. That's the word. You know, they're constructs, but they're ideas and concepts that are put in our head really young. They're quite insidious. They're prolific. We all have them. It's omnipresent. And you can't even get around them. You can only begin to identify them and be more wary of them and conscious of them in yourselves. And that's how this is where the psychedelics come in my opinion. So if you say like, okay, we're environmentalists, we're feminists, and by the way, everybody can be a feminist. You do not have to be female to be a feminist. So it's correct, anybody who correct. Cares about these issues, who cares about the plight of females, which has negatively affected the evolution of humanity and where we are, where we have landed, even with the wonderful things that we do as a species. We're destroying ourselves. We're destroying the planet. We're destroying all the other life on Earth. We are so close to just completely ruining it all, that if we don't get beyond this, we're the worst species on the planet. I don't want to be that. Do you want to be that? So I think psychedelics can help us to really get to these things that we hide from ourselves, that we're not aware of. They're so deep, or help us to understand ourselves. And by the way, none of this is really new either. This is, again, going back to the Gaia, right? My ancestry on that side. If you go to where the Gaia temple was today, it was taken over by the patriarchy too. It became Apollo's Delphi, okay? It was originally for Gaia. There's still a navel of the universe. I love that right there. And they understand that it's there right at Delphi. And that is sort of acknowledging the original, which is the goddess Gaia, the earth, the living earth, right? But at Delphi, you have those maxims. And one of them is they're all of a psychedelic culture. You understand they were all working with medicines, just like we're doing now in the Renaissance. They were working with medicines, psychoactive and psychedelic, and combinatory brews. Right? So they were looking at these three things. These are the big things that you saw if you managed to get to Delphi, which was quite a journey. People came from all over, right? They came as far as Egypt and Israel. They came from very far away to get to Delphi. You wanted to go there in your life to get this experience. This was like going to Peru today to an ayahuasca retreat, right? So you go there and you get these maxims like, know thyself. Well, yeah, isn't that the point? Know thyself. Psychedelics and psychoactives help us to know ourselves. We can do it without, we can learn about ourselves in many, many ways, but they help us see what we're unable to see or is much harder to see without them, right? Everything in moderation. These are also translations into English, but everything in moderation. It's one of the things I wanted to share with you today, Jonathan, because I see this in the scene today. It is a good idea to curb your psychedelic use. And I don't even like the word use. You know, be respectful and mindful. And that word bothers me too, but respectful of your intake. You know, if you want to respect the sacred medicines, they should not be habitual. And constantly, constantly, constantly going and drinking ayahuasca or doing LSD or whatever it is you do, over and over and over without proper time off to truly integrate is not wise. And that leads to the third maxim at Delphi, which was absolutism leads to ruin and or insanity, and that's again translated, so it's sort of insanity and ruin are the same, but absolute knowing, so this idea of I am right, this is right, is not it's not a good idea either. So again, these are three, like, you think about that, just those three little wisdom pieces from the old world and the psychedelic culture today. And I think that we're just relearning and rediscovering, and you know, yeah, we're inventing our own too, but if you go back, you look at a lot of this stuff was done for us. These three things are just one example of ancient wisdom that's very relevant today.
Yeah, and needless to say, psychedelic and psychedelic compounds have been used over time for many, many centuries. You've touched upon before about ancient rituals and ceremonial processes, and it's perhaps that I'd love us to touch upon here. Now, Zoe, for you, how important do you believe the ceremonial and ritual aspect of psychedelic culture, psychedelic ingestion, how important do you think these are to the psychedelics movement? And as an extension of that, as a professional industry, both on the business and medical side of things, has really burgeoned and developed, in particular in the last few years, there's really been a psychedelic renaissance. How do you believe that these ancient ceremonial and ritual practices are best reconciled with the modern industry, so to speak?
Well, you know, we talk about this a lot here at home with Chris, my husband Chris. And he's one of these people who really enjoy just sort of, you know, taking LSD and going out in the desert. You know, so there's a ritual there, but it's your own. And what I mentioned in the early 90s with cannabis, I was doing that on my own. But the mushrooms were with Greenpeace, meaning a community of people who were out there fighting literally door to door, trying to convince people to care about things with the earth. They would go into Jamaica Plain. It was a cemetery. It was very beautiful. It was definitely a community gathering. But was there a shaman or a healer or even anybody leading a trance-like thing or saying anything? No. It was just loving people handing out mushrooms, and we were all together as a little tribe out there in a beautiful summer evening that was very, very rainy, I remember. But warm. So a warm summer rain at night and in this gorgeous park setting that seemed to go on for eternity. So there was something very sacred about it. And here's an interesting thing. Again, just to keep on the same historical or herstorical, I should say, line in my matrilineal line, there is the word temenos. And temenos, you may have heard temenos, but temenos is the first version of it. It's the indigenous Greek, even though nobody called it them Greeks. Greek is a later term. Okay, so whoever the so-called pre-Greeks were, we know that the word temenos was used for sacred space. So interestingly enough, if you really look into that, sacred space can also be called a temple or a sanctuary, and sometimes it's out in nature. It doesn't have to necessarily be an enclosed area, but it can be if that feels safe. I think it's about the setting the space, right? And saying, this is the space we're going to have this special community gathering with this special sacred plant or fungi or combinatory brew, this medicine, and we're going to do the following together, whatever that is. And that becomes the ritual too. So I think that that's important to acknowledge. There are people doing that, and that's always been around, and that's also wonderful. Then on the other side, you can have, well, in that same sort of genre, but different. If you go to, let's say, Pucallpa or Iquitos in Peru, and you work with Shipibo indigenous people who have been trained and who are, you know, chosen and trained to be healers in their language, Onaya, ancestral healer, they are specifically working with their traditional medicines and their traditional ceremonial traditions. And as those have evolved, because they are always evolving, and they also survived colonial forces several times. So their version as ayahuasca people is a profoundly amazing experience. If you are welcomed into one of their malocas, which is their temenos, right? It's a beautiful little, usually round, but not always, hut in the middle of the jungle. And it's usually has a grass, you know, roof, and it's just magical as can be. And that particular space is sacred. You take off your shoes when you go in, you're ready for ceremony. You agree to certain things as a community. You make an agreement or agreements of how you're going to behave as well and what you're going to do together. That is important, I think. But it's not completely necessary. Maybe walking on the beach and taking a mushroom is going to be great for somebody. Maybe their world's going to change. Maybe the community they need to deal with is inside themselves, like who they are in the world. Sometimes it's very individual. Now, if you're talking about more of a sort of classic psychiatrist or psychologist versus, quote, patient, unquote, situation in an office on a couch, that's an entirely different situation. I'm not saying it's not as good or less good or what. Everyone's different, and different situations require different things. Everybody doesn't want to go to Peru and be in that little maloca. That terrifies some people. Just the idea of being around insects terrifies some people. It's amazing to me. But to me, going there is also part of respecting and supporting the indigenous people. Because if we don't go, then they don't have anybody who can help them to do this as a profession. Just like artists, you know, you can be an artist unless you're independently wealthy. You need somebody to buy your paintings or your pottery or whatever it is you do, your music, or you can't continue to do it full time. And doing it full time, you get better. So it actually supports people if you go to a proper indigenous setting in Peru. But in terms of how the rest of the world is doing it, again, there's so many dimensions to this question. I think one of them is access. Not everybody can go to Peru. I'm still using the Peru example, but there are many examples. Not everybody has that money. Not everybody has that time. Not everybody would feel safe doing that. There's also a lot of questions about safety there. You have people who are taking over the indigenous kind of, what I'm trying to say is appropriating is the word. I hesitate to use the word cultural appropriation, but there is cultural appropriation, and there's plenty going on in Peru. So in my opinion, you need to actually support the indigenous people there, or you are culturally appropriating. And you also have to help the place itself, the jungle, the rainforest, the environment that is there, which also supports the indigenous people because they care about those things. So I think that if you look at people who are on the other end and are taking, let's say, ayahuasca out of the jungle or to other countries, that's when it gets tricky for me. And you're not going to, the problem is that you and I and people like us having conversations about this culturally and our responsibility to do the right thing, to do the ethical thing, it takes work. You have to educate yourself. You can't just jump in and decide, oh, I know everything about it, and spout out language like accessibility when you're not really looking at the other side of it. You know, I've heard people say, oh, we have one in Costa Rica because it's more accessible. Okay, then what are you doing for the Shipibo people back in Peru? Oh, well, we bring people here to our center. Well, is that okay with them? Oh, yes, they want to come. Well, what happens to their families? That's a tribal setting a lot of times. You're disrupting this the setting there. And, you know, is it only that you're hiring them to come to your... What are you really doing? And some people aren't doing anything. They're just doing their own ceremony. So all I think that these things are important, and a lot of people, not just me, not just Chris, a lot of people in this scene, my friends, my colleagues, are talking about this. It's not just me, for anybody who's hearing this for the first time. This is a big conversation happening in the scene right now, and it's important. And I think, you know, you'd asked about psychedelic feminism, and to me, bringing up the ecofeminism is a part of caring about the planet. We have to care about the planet. If we're, I don't feel that we, all right, how can I put it? These are nature's medicines. These are the medicines that are interesting to me. There are others that are, you know, chemistry, and they're being made chemistry, like, you know, in labs. And that's another conversation. You know, you could, I suppose, say that that's nature too, because everything's nature and we're creating them and we're natural and they're coming from the elements, and then chemistry is nature too. And you could argue that and you could be right. But the problem that we're facing, the biggest problem to me right now in the world as human beings, is that we think we're separate from nature. We think we're better than nature. Just like male supremacy, there is human supremacy. It's a big thing. Most people don't even think about it. We are nature. We're not like working with psychedelics to get back to nature. If you're getting back to nature, you're getting back to yourself. You're getting back to understand that you are one with nature. You are not separate. There's no separation, right? So when you start to say, okay, I'm going to go into a very safe little room in a hospital and I'm going to put something over my eyes and listen to canned music that I don't know, that I may not like, that is definitely going to affect my trip, and I'm going to have somebody there who's trained in their particular ways, who may be really talented and maybe really skilled, but maybe isn't, because not every shrink is great. And, you know, and take this thing that they're going to give me that may or may not be a medicine that really you relate to. And to me, you know, the magic, part of the magic is the Temenah, is the place, the sacred place. And, you know, Temenahs, like I said, can be in outdoor spaces. They can be something special. They're usually a special place, like a clearing in a woods or a really beautiful plateau on a mountaintop. You know, these are places where you can really feel the energy and the beauty and the magic of nature, and they do add to the ceremonial power. So I think it's all good, okay? I think that people find their ways toward with these medicines, but I can't answer this all for you. It's just too complicated, but it's just at least a few things to consider, right?
Absolutely. These questions are far bigger than being solved in an hour or on a podcast or in one conversation. There is so much to be explored here. And now, Zoe, perhaps as a final question before the clock beats us here, and that is, from your own experience, as someone who has both had many ceremonial experiences with psychedelics in the, I guess, correct settings, be it with peyote or ayahuasca in Peru and other places where you've been, but also someone who has had experiences and psychedelic experiences, you know, not in a traditional ceremonial or ritual capacity. You spoke earlier about sort of using high doses of cannabis to elicit psychedelic experiences for yourself. Also, the having mushrooms sat with a group of people in a cemetery. As someone who has experienced both sides of the coin, for you personally, and this very much isn't a loaded question, but I'd really love to understand for you personally, where have you found the most profound experiences to have been? And do you believe that they are a result of the ceremony, the setting, the time of life? What really speaks to you here?
They've all been profound. They've all been profound. I wouldn't want to have missed any of them. You know, I used to tell people about an experience once where Chris and I were with NBC Nightly News in the Amazon, and we'd been there for a week in a native village, an indigenous village, Shipibo, and they were, you know, really struggling, and we were trying to bring in some good plant medicine trade so that they would have something to build for themselves, to become self-sufficient. And at the end, you know, we got quite close to the people, and in the end, they sent their village shaman to our little hut where we were with the crew from NBC Nightly News, and they brought ayahuasca. And it the people we were with weren't necessarily thrilled about that, but we knew that we couldn't say no. So we, you know, I remember saying, Chris, let's maybe not drink a lot. Maybe we drink a little bit. We were already experienced enough. So I just took a little teeny capsule. And of course, the brews are always very different, but this wasn't a strong brew. And I used to say, you know, I didn't get much. But now, as I've thought, as I've had years to integrate that experience, I realized that what I got that night was extremely important to me. It was, I had this sensation that a small light, like a beautiful, warm light, glowing light, almost like you sometimes see fairies in the movies depicted, you know, like a golden light coming out, kind of like a star zigzagging or sort of moving along, but towards me, and it got bigger as it came towards me, and it was my papu, my grandfather, my mother's father, who was from the tribal homeland, and it was him. It didn't look like him, but it was him, without a doubt, and all his love beaming out, checking in on me. And as soon as I recognized him, all the others started coming. And then suddenly there was this just massive amount of these beautiful stars coming towards me. And it was just almost all just stars, like a beautiful galaxy coming towards me from wherever. I suppose, you know, the ancient Greeks would say Hades, the underworld, the other world, where the spirits are, or where the psyches live. And I was love bombed, you know. It wasn't just love, it was celebrating that I was alive and celebrating that they were part of me. They were in my DNA and my genetic memory, if you want to make it scientific, that they were part of me and that I was here because of them and that they loved me and believed in me and wanted me to have the best life. It was so beautiful and powerful at that time. Now, would I have had that in a dream? They've come to me in my dreams. My dreams can be pretty amazing and quite psychedelic. It's different. It's different. So the ayahuasca allowed me to get to that. So was this a ceremonial setting? Yes and no. It was a strange one. I wouldn't have wanted to be there if I didn't have experience. I felt strong enough in my, you know, my knowledge of working with the medicine, or my experience, I suppose, of working with ayahuasca specifically, to take that risk. And I had that beautiful experience. But the dose was teeny, okay? So when I wanted to just say, when you mentioned high doses of cannabis, again, it's like, it depends on who you are. I did not need high doses. I took surprisingly small doses at that time. I was very, very sensitive to those medicines, and some people are. So back to that, so much of this is the intention. And even when I was doing the art for myself with the cannabis, I had intentions. I just didn't call them that. I was just working with my own, what I had been taught as an artist, which was a lot. And art and psychedelics, I mean, really go together. And there's a lot in common with that, the healing arts, if you will. So I had a goal, or it was a loose goal because it was a creative goal. But I worked with these medicines towards that goal. And I think I was creating my own ritual. Here's the answer, if I have to give you an answer. What I would think would be unhealthy is that if I had back then, or today, or anyone else doing it today, worked on my own solely for an extended period of time, that could have potentially put me in a bad situation. Because what if I was going in the wrong direction or an unhealthy direction? What if I was going into a weird psychosis, or whether I was developing some sort of weird thing? Like people do. People develop things like, you know, they have mania. They have, you know, narcissistic kind of expressions with psychedelics. They have sometimes, you know, messiah complexes or savior complexes. You know, those things to me are just, I don't want to have those ever. Okay. So if you're with a community that you can trust, that knows you enough and cares about you enough to kind of help you check yourself, that's nothing but a good idea. And, you know, again, you have to consider what the community is then. You have to consider, you know, you, what if your community is a bunch of people who are giving you the wrong messages, or maybe it's a culty kind of situation which isn't healthy. So all of these questions come into play. Just be very, very careful out there. I do not think it's a good idea to have prolonged solo, you know, work. I think it's really, really important to seek like-minded or like-spirited individuals who are also on this journey, because we really are kind of a renaissance, which means we're rediscovering. And these older cultures were working with these medicines for a very, very long time. And there are things you learn. You know, I mentioned the Shipibo people. I have seen things happen in ceremony. They have words in their language for those things. What if you didn't? What if somebody in your group drank ayahuasca and had that experience of whatever, maybe not being able to walk for 3 hours or seemingly dying? These things happen. They're perfectly fine, and they're a thing that happens sometimes in an ayahuasca ceremony. But these healers have passed down that knowledge and that wisdom in their training. And so if it happens, they know what to deal with it, how to deal with it, you know? So it's, I think it's all of the above. I think they're all good to an extent. The most important thing is integration, integration, integration. That word is overused. So people just kind of tend to think it's something where you can just get a little brochure or something and learn about it. Yeah, that's a start. But integration means doing it yourself. It means going into your life with the lessons you've learned, with the thing, the not even just the lessons, the hints. You know, the messages and hints that you've gotten in these experiences. How are you going to bring them into your real, true life in the real world? How is it going to shape your behavior towards yourself, towards others, towards the planet? How is it going to change you in a good way? It takes time. And if you're constantly working with these plant medicines over and over and over and not giving yourself enough time, that's not good. Working with these ancestral medicines, and, you know, I mention a lot about my mother's side and the ancient pre-Greek, I feel that I have a right to work with my ancestral medicines, to do my ancestral work. My people were traumatized on both sides. You and I have talked about my Jewish side. Jews, of course, carry a great deal of trauma. So do the Greeks. So do the Celts, also on my father's side. Peoples have experienced traumas. Also, we carry treasures, beautiful, amazing things, cultural contributions, you know, traditions, stories, myth, art, just wonderful, wonderful stuff in there. And some of this has to do with which medicines our ancestors were working with. I want to explore those. I want to explore all the things that I'm learning intellectually. I want to explore those with the medicine, and they're not legal. You know, I can't do that. I'm in the United States. I cannot legally work with poppies, for example. Poppies were a big medicine on my mother's side all the way back, many thousands of years. And that's evidence-based for any patriarchal types out there. It's quite evidence-based. I would really like to experience it. I've never experienced it. I've never experienced any opioid except for like a pharmaceutical pain reliever. That's the closest I could get. Now, I could get that. I could take a bunch of Percocets and try to have a really beautiful experience with the ancient mother. But you know what? It's not the same. Plus, I think there were combinatory brews. I'd like to explore that. I'd like to have access to these medicines legally, safely, to do my own personal work, and I do not. So on that note, going back to cannabis, you know, many people still can't work with cannabis legally. And that's, to me, we're so used to it here, and we're so grateful that it's legal here in Massachusetts. We can even grow our own. We can give it as gifts. We can't sell it, but we can give it as gifts. So access to these medicines is, I think, it's a right. It's a core human right. And if that was the last thing I shared with the people on this podcast, to me, that's really where I'm at the moment.
Well, you can rest assured that pretty much all the folks who will be tuning into this will agree with you. Access to these medicines are absolutely key, whether it's cannabis, whether it's ayahuasca, peyote. We're living in a world now where we're breaking down the taboos and we're really understanding, and there's an increasing mainstream understanding that these compounds are, and these botanicals are medicines. They're not things to be feared. They're things to improve our lives. Zoe, it has been wonderful as always speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on the Professionally Psychedelics podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.